You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 232 by Rudolf Steiner, 14 lectures, revised translation by Pauline Werla, and entitled Mystery Knowledge and Mystery Centers. This is Lecture 6, entitled The Mysteries of Ephesian Artemis. When people speak about the Word today, they usually only mean the weak human Word, which has so little significance in comparison with the majesty of the universe indicated at the beginning of St. John's Gospel, with the momentous words, quote, "In the beginning was the Word, the Logos, and the Word was with God, and a God was the Word," close quote. And anyone who reflects on this most significant opening of St. John's Gospel must ask himself, what does it mean when the Word is placed at the primal beginning of all things? What is actually meant by the Logos, the Word? And what connection does it have with our trivial human words? Now, the name of John is also connected with the city of Ephesus. And if someone who is equipped with imaginative perception of the world's history contemplates the momentous words, quote, "In the primal beginning was the Logos, and the Logos was with God, and a God was the Logos," close quote, he will be directed time and again by an inner path to the ancient temple of Diana at Ephesus. For anyone who has attained a certain degree of initiation, the enigma presented in the first verses of St. John's Gospel points to the mysteries of the temple of Artemis or Diana at Ephesus. And so it must seem to him that knowledge of the mysteries of Ephesus will help him to understand the beginning of the St. John's Gospel. Prepared by what we have heard in the last 2 days, let us think of the mysteries of the temple of Diana at Ephesus as they were 6 or 7 centuries before the birth of Christianity, or even earlier, and of what was done in the sanctuary which was held to be so holy by the people of old. Then we find that the instruction given in the mysteries at Ephesus did indeed begin with drawing attention to the sounds of human speech. We can learn not from any historical account, for the barbarism of humanity took great care that such records were destroyed, but from the Akashic record, that thought record in the ether, where the events of world history are inscribed and which is accessible to spiritual sight. It is from this record that we can learn about what went on in these Ephesian mysteries. And the Akashic record reveals again and again how the teacher, first of all, directed the attention of his pupils to human speech. Again and again the pupil was urged to learn to feel in his own speech organs what actually took place when he spoke. The processes at work in speech elude crude perception, for they are delicate and intimate. But let us consider, first of all, the external aspect of speech, for it was from this that the instruction given in these mysteries took its start. The attention of the pupil was first directed to the way in which the words sound forth from the mouth. He was told over and over again, quote, "Mark well what you feel when the word sounds forth from your mouth," close quote. He was then taught to notice how something of the spoken word turns upward in order to receive the thought in the head, while something from the same word turns downward in order that the feeling content may be inwardly experienced. Again and again the pupil was instructed to push through his throat the utmost extremes of speech, and thereby to perceive the ebb and flow manifest in the word as it is uttered. Quote, I am not, close quote, a positive and a negative assertion. These he had to utter as articulately as possible, and then observe how, in the words I am, the upward ascent is felt, while in the I am not, there is more the feeling of pressing downward. Then the attention of the pupil was turned more toward the intimate feelings and experiences connected with the word. He became aware that from the word, something like warmth rises up toward the head, and this warmth, this fire, intercepts thought. And something like a watery element flows downward in the same way as a glandular secretion is discharged into the organism. Thus it was made clear to the pupils in the Ephesian mysteries that human beings make use of the air in order for the word to sound forth. But in the act of speaking, the air changes into the next element, into fire, warmth, drawing the thought down from the heights of the head, embodying it in itself. And there occurs as alternating conditions, first ascending upward of fire, then ascending downward, as the air in the word trickles down like a glandular secretion in the form of water, a fluid. By means of this latter process, human beings can feel the word inwardly. The pupil was then led into the real secret of speech. This secret is connected, however, with the mystery of the human being. Nowadays, the secret of the human being is hidden from scientists, inasmuch as science places at the summit of all thought the incredible caricature of truth, the so-called law of the conservation of energy and matter. Within the human being, matter is continually being transformed. It does not endure. The air that is pushed out of the throat is transformed in the process, alternately, into the next higher element, warmth or fire, or into the element of water, fire, water, fire, water. Thus the pupil at Ephesus came to understand that when he spoke, a wave movement issued from his mouth, fire, water, fire, water. What this actually means is a striving up of the word into the realm of thought, and a trickling down of the word into the realm of feeling. Thus thought and feeling interweave in speech, inasmuch as the living wave movement of speech, beginning as air, first rarefies to fire, then densifies to water, and so on, again and again. And this was what the pupil had to feel when the great truth, arising in his own speaking, was brought home to him in the mysteries of Ephesus. Quote, "Speak, O man, and you reveal through yourself world genesis." Close quote. This is really how things were in Ephesus, that when the pupil entered the portal of the mysteries, he was always reminded of the words, quote, "Speak, O man, and you reveal through yourself world genesis," close quote. And when he departed, the words were said to him in the other form, quote, "World genesis is revealed through you, O man, when you speak," close quote. Then the pupil gradually began to feel that he, with his own body, was a kind of sheath for the cosmic mystery that sounded from his rhythmic system and lived in his speech. All this was brought to the pupil to prepare him for the much deeper mystery. For this preparation enabled him to know that his own human nature was inwardly connected with the mystery of the cosmos. The saying, "Know yourself," acquired holy meaning, inasmuch as it was not only spoken of as a theory, but could be inwardly and solemnly felt and experienced. Then, after the pupil had, so to speak, ennobled his being in this way, and was able to feel it to be as a sheath enveloping the cosmic mystery, he could be led still farther and come to know the power that spread the mystery over the wide spaces of the cosmos. And in this connection, let us remember what we were looking at yesterday. I described a condition in the evolution of the earth when the following occurred. The earth was in the condition when it contained as a substance, essential for that stage of evolution, what we now know as common chalk, such as is found in the Jura Mountains. In the chalk mountains, in the chalk of the earth today, we find the substance we want to study with regard to its function in those ancient times, when the earth was surrounded by what I called fluid albumen. We know that cosmic forces worked into the fluid albumin, causing it to coagulate into certain definite forms. And while the earth was in this condition, a process took place, resembling in a higher degree and in a denser substance what we know today as the rising of the mist and the falling of the rain. The chalky element rose upward and permeated what had hardened in the fluid albumin, so that these forms acquired a bony content and the animal kingdom began to evolve. Through the spirituality contained in the chalk, the animals were drawn down, as it were, out of the atmosphere, which was still albuminous. I also said something else. I said that a human being is aware of all these happenings in his feelings. If he unites himself with the metallic element, the metallity of the earth, he feels all these things as though it were his own being, as a memory within himself. And with regard to that stage of evolution, he felt he was not yet a small human being enclosed in his skin, but that he encompassed the whole of planet Earth. To put it grotesquely, I might say that to begin with, the human being felt that chiefly his head encompassed the whole Earth planet. The processes described in the last lecture were felt by the human being to be taking place in himself. But how? Everything I have described to you here as the rising of the chalk, the uniting of this chalk with the coagulated albumin, and then the descent of animality onto the earth, all this was experienced by the human being of that time in such a way that he heard it. You must try to imagine this. He experienced it inwardly, and in so doing he heard it. The forms that arose when the chalk filled out the coagulated albumin and made it bony and gristly, all that then took shape was felt in the ear. It was audible. The cosmic mystery was heard. And it is the same today. When human beings learn in memory about the past of the earth, the memory that is kindled by the metals comes to them as though they heard it sounding. And in this sound, the stream of cosmic happenings lives and weaves. What is it that human beings hear? What is revealed? What is disclosed to them? The stream of cosmic happenings manifests as the cosmic word, as the Logos. It is the Logos, the cosmic word, that resounds in the rising and falling of the chalk. And if human beings are able to hear this language within themselves, they will become aware of something else besides. The following will actually enter the bounds of possibility. My dear friends, imagine yourselves standing in front of a human or an animal skeleton. What modern anatomy says about the skeleton is dreadfully superficial. But when, with inner mindfulness of the reality of nature and of spirit, we look at a skeleton, what do we feel? We say to ourselves, quote, "Do not merely look at it," close quote. It is terrible merely to look at it as it presents itself with its forms, the spinal column with its wonderfully shaped intersecting vertebra, with the ribs bending and curving forward, with all the wonderful articulation as the vertebra are metamorphosed into the bones of the skull, and that even more mysterious articulation, where the ribs bending to embrace the chest from either side, then with a sharp turn, form themselves into the arm bones and the leg bones. Confronted with this mystery of the skeleton, we can do no other than say to ourselves, quote, "Do not merely look, but listen. Listen how one bone transforms itself into another. Listen, for it speaks," close quote. At this point, let me make a personal remark. When, with a feeling for these things, we go into a natural history museum, we are confronted by something really miraculous. For there, we have a collection of what are really musical instruments, forming a mighty orchestra and resounding in the most wonderful way. I experienced this very deeply when I once visited the museum in Trieste. There, due to a particular way the animal skeletons were arranged, this was quite instinctive. One could hear resound, one after the other, at one end of the animal the secrets of the moon, and at the other end the secrets of the sun. And the whole hall was as though filled with resounding suns and planets. One could certainly feel the connection between the skeleton, the bony system living in the chalk, and that which, once upon a time, spoke to the human being out of the flowing forces of the cosmos, when he himself was one with the cosmos, with the secret of the cosmos, which is at the same time the secret of the human being himself. The beings which arose first of all, the animals, sounded forth in this way what they are. For after all, animal nature lived in the Logos, in the sounding cosmic mystery. One did not perceive two separate phenomena. One did not perceive the animals and then, in some way or other, the inner being of the animals. The actual genesis and development of the animal and its whole being, that was what spoke. The pupil of the Ephesian mysteries could receive, heart and soul, in the right way for that ancient time, what could then be revealed concerning the primal beginning, when the Word, the Logos, lived and moved as the inner essence of all things. The pupil could take it in, because he had been prepared by the ennobling and sublimating of his human nature to feel himself to be a vessel for the faint reflection of the cosmic mystery contained in the sounding forth of his own speech. And now let us feel how the evolutionary process has passed, as it were, from one level to the other. Let us take a look at it. In the chalk element we still have something which was then fluid. It rose as vapor and fell again as rain. As it rose, it was transmuted into air. As it descended, it was changed into earth. So there was water, air, and earth there, which was a level lower than in the human copy of it, where we have air, warmth, and water. In those primeval times, the still fluid chalk rarefied to air and condensed to earth, just as in our throat today the air rarefies to warmth and condenses to water. The element which lived in the world has risen from water to air. In former times it lived in water, condensed to earth and rarefied to air. This rose to the level of air, where it rarefied to warmth and condensed to water. And this makes it possible for us human beings to encompass the cosmic memory in miniature. While it was still on a large scale and was the great Maya of the world, it was one level lower. The earth densified everything. The chalk became denser, and so on. We human beings would not have been able to contain the cosmic mystery in this form, even if it had approached us on a miniature scale. We could contain it only when it rose one stage higher from water to air, and surged up and down into warmth and into water, which is now the denser element. Thus, what was of universal dimension, the macrocosmic mystery, became the microcosmic mystery of human speech. And it is to this macrocosmic mystery, the translation into Maya, into the big world, that the beginning of St. John's Gospel refers. Quote, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." Close quote. For that was still a living tradition in Ephesus, at the time when the evangelist, the writer of St. John's Gospel, could read there in the Akashic record that for which his heart yearned, namely the right form in which to clothe what he had to say to mankind concerning the secret of cosmic evolution. But we can go a step farther. We can remind ourselves of what we said yesterday, namely that prior to chalk there was silica, which appears today in quartz. In this the plant forms appeared like greening and fading cloud formations. And if, as I said, human beings had at that time been able to look out into the wide spaces of the cosmos, they would have seen this evolution of animal nature, and would have seen, too, those primeval plants greening and fading away. But all this was, of course, an inner perception, The human being perceived it as belonging to his own being. Besides hearing as a living inner experience the sounding of animal nature coming into being, he could also in a certain sense accompany inwardly what he heard, in the same way as in his own head, in his chest and head, he ascends with his words by way of warmth to grasp thoughts. And he could proceed from what he heard resounding from the evolution of the animals to an experiencing of the evolution of the plants. This was the remarkable thing, my dear friends. The human being could experience the living being of animal creation in the rarefying and descending chalk. And when he then directed his attention to what was happening in the silica element, the greening and fading of plant nature, then the cosmic word became cosmic thought, for the plants in the silica element added thought to the resounding word. An ascending step was taken, and cosmic thought was added to the sounding logos. Just as today thought is grasped in the element of fire and comes to meet the word of speech as speech surges between fire and water. My dear friends, if you study today how those particular pathological conditions connected with the sense organs of the head and with the sense organs in general are treated, you'll hear of the healing effects of silica. Whereas here, in the context of world secrets, silica shows itself to be specifically the thought element in the greening and fading plant forms. Was I not able to say of it that it was the perception, the medium, for perceiving the whole structure of the cosmos? In a wonderful way, there actually comes to expression microcosmically in present-day human beings what has occurred in the evolution of life in the macrocosm. Just think for a moment how human beings lived then, lived still at one with the cosmos, in unity with the cosmos. When a human being thinks today, he has to think of himself as being isolated in his head. The thoughts are inside, and the words come out. The cosmos is outside. Words can only point to the cosmos. Thoughts can only mirror it. This was not so when the human being was still one with the macrocosm. He then experienced the cosmos as though it were within himself. The word was at the same time the environment, and thought was the element that permeated this environment. The human being listened, and what he heard was world. When he looked away from what he heard, he looked into himself. The word was first of all sound. The word was first of all something struggling to be deciphered. The creation of the animals was a manifestation of something struggling to be deciphered. The animal kingdom arose in the chalk element as a question. Human beings looked into the silica element, and the being of the plants gave the answer out of what it had received as a sense organ of the earth, and solved the riddle set it by the animal kingdom. The beings themselves solved each other's riddles. One being, in this case the animal, put the question, and the other being, in this case the plant, gave the answer. And the whole world became speech. We may venture to say that this is the reality in the beginning of St. John's Gospel. For in the first place we are taken back to a primal beginning of everything that exists. In this primal beginning, in this principle, was the Word. And the Word was with God, and the Word was God, because it was the creative essence in everything. It is really and truly so that the teaching given to the pupils of the mysteries at Ephesus contains what led to the beginning of the St. John's Gospel. And here let me say that the time is fully ripe for anthroposophists to turn to these secrets lying hidden in the past. For you see, in a very particular and special sense, the building which stood here on the Dornach Hill, the Gertianum, had become the central point of anthroposophical striving. The pain in us today must live on further as pain, and will do so in everyone who is able to feel what the Gertianum was intended to be. But whatever takes place in the physical world around us, that, my dear friends, for one who is striving upward in his knowledge toward the spiritual realm, must be at the same time an external revelation, a picture of something deeper, something spiritual. If on the one hand we have to accept this pain, then we, as human beings striving for spiritual knowledge, must nevertheless be able to turn what has happened into an opportunity for looking into an ever-deepening revelation. This Gertianum was truly a place in which human beings endeavored to speak, in fact, did speak, again and again, of the things connected with the beginning of St. John's Gospel. Quote, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God," close quote. And then this Gertianum went up in flames. And we can have this terrible picture of the burning Gertianum. And out of the pain can be born the urge to look ever more deeply into this image, which is still there in our thought, the image of the Gertianum burning down on New Year's Eve. Although this was such a painful event, it was nevertheless one that can lead into greater and greater depths of knowledge. Something was to have been founded there, something that had a connection with the Gospel of St. John. In a certain sense, we may say that this placed itself into the consuming flames. And we can form a most important resolution to allow these flames to prompt us to look through them to other flames, which in past times consumed the temple of Ephesus. Let that be a challenge to us, to acquire a sense and purpose for inquiring into what is contained in the beginning of St. John's Gospel. Urged on by these painful but holy demands, let us look back from that gospel to the temple of Ephesus, which was also burned down long ago, and then the Gertianum flames, speaking to us so painfully and eloquently, will serve to remind us of what streamed into the Akashic record, together with the flames of the burning temple of Ephesus. Having beheld on that tragic night the consuming flames of the burning Gertianum, do we not still see the molten metals of the musical instruments? And do we not have in the flames these metals of the musical instruments uttering in clear tones their holy speech, introducing magically into the flames the most remarkable colors, auspicious colors, colors akin to the metals? And through this connection with the metallic element, there rises up within us something that is like memory in the earthly sphere. And what it reminds us of is what went up in flames with the temple of Ephesus. Then, even as there is a connection between those two fires, so the longing to probe further into something of the nature of, quote, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God," close quote, can link us to what was brought home again and again to the pupil at Ephesus, quote, "Study the mystery of man in the small word, the micro-logos, in order to make yourself ripe to experience within yourself the mystery of the macro-logos," close quote. Human beings are microcosms in relation to the world, which is the macrocosm, but they also bear within themselves cosmic mysteries. And we shall penetrate more deeply into the cosmic mystery contained in the first three verses of St. John's Gospel, if we look in the right way at what was spoken of, among many other things, by the flames of the Gertianum, densified, as it were, to a kind of script. Quote, "Behold the Logos in the consuming fire. Interpret it in Diana's house." Close quote. The fiery Akasha of New Year's Eve speaks these and many other words very clearly. And it presents us with the challenge to discover in the microcosm the micro-logos, so that we human beings may gain an understanding for that from which our own being proceeds, namely, for the macrocosm through the macro-logos. The end of Lecture 6.